please find your seats? We want to start the program. Okay. Good evening. I'm Naomi Steinberger. I'm the Director of Library Services at the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary, and I want to welcome you to a very exciting and very full program about the Jews of India and the Jewish communities in India. This program is part of a series that we've been running as part of a grant that we received for the processing and publicizing of the archival collection of Johanna Spector. The grant was received by CLEAR with funding from the Mellon Foundation, and we are grateful to them and to our wonderful archivists for bringing this collection to light. Just as an introduction, Johanna Spector was born in Latvia in 1915. She is a Holocaust survivor, and after the war could no longer play the piano, at which point she shifted her focus to studying vanishing Jewish communities throughout the world and made her way to the United States. She was the first female tenured professor at JTS, where she taught ethnomusicology until her retirement in 1985. She willed the collection to the library after her death in 2008, and we are now working on bringing this collection to the public. You'll hear a bit more about her in a moment. This evening we will show two film clips. First is a film produced by Johanna Spector about the Jews of Cochin. The second is an interview with Ralphie Girard about the Bnei Yisrael, the Jews of Mumbai. We'll present some Indian treasures from the library's collection, and we are honored to have Peter Geffen, a true visionary in Jewish education. Among his credits are the founding of the Heschel School, and most recently, founder and director of Kivunim, a gap year study program that studies and experiences the history of the Jewish people from different communities around the world. We are partnering with Peter and three students who are graduates of Kivunim to share some of their insights and experiences within the Jewish community. Let me briefly introduce the students. You'll see them up here later on in the program. Isabel Nelson participated in Kivunim in 2011 and 12. She is a sophomore at Barnard College studying neuroscience. She is from Olympia, Washington, and plans to study in Seville next semester. Asha Krell is currently a chemical engineering student at Columbia and working in a joint BABS at Brandeis. Then I'm not sure how that works, but we can ask him later. He's from Birmingham, Alabama, and was on Kivunim in 2008 and 9. He would like to continue his education and in an MD-PhD program. And William Sachs just completed his junior year at NYU, where he's studying finance and accounting at the Stern School for Business. He's from Baltimore and was on Kivunim in 2010-11. I want to thank Peter, his student, and Isabel, Asher, and William for joining us tonight. Just one more message. Please turn off your cell phone so that we're not interrupted. And please hold your comments or questions, and hopefully at the end we'll have a few moments to have some question and answers. Now let me introduce David Kramer. He is the librarian at JTS, and he will continue.
Thank you, Naomi, and everyone who is contributing to this program tonight. I'm going to actually participate in two capacities this evening. The first is quite simply to say a little bit more about Johanna Spector as she became interested in the communities, in the Jewish communities of India. The material, or I should say the information that I'm sharing with you here was provided by Cala Biondi, who is the archivist in charge of this project, and so I'm grateful to her for providing us all with the details. Johanna Spector did her doctoral work at the Hebrew Union College. When she graduated in 1950, she arranged a research fellowship in Israel to study the musical traditions and especially chazanut, cantillation, of national groups relocating there, that is Israel, from other places. She was in Israel from 1951 to 1953, about 2.5 years, focusing on Middle Eastern Jewish music and to some degree also Jewish communities from Asia. On her return home from that stay in Israel, she stopped in London to visit friends and family, and to give several lectures that were sponsored by the University of London. While she was there at the University of London, she attended a reception after one lecture where she met one Dr. V. Raghavan, who is the secretary of the Music Academy of Madras, India, and a scholar of Indian music who invited her to visit the academy in India. Now, I don't know what happened between 1953 and 1961. I didn't get that information from Calla, but according to what she provided, it was in 1961 that Johanna Spector finally made her way to Madras as part of a 2-month round-the-world tour. And she spoke, as she had been invited, at the annual conference of the Musical Academy there in Madras. Now, we don't know anything, meaning from direct information, the archives or other sources, about what connected Johanna Spector and her experience in Madras to the Jewish communities elsewhere in India. So some of what I say here is speculation based upon other things we know, but given who she was and the way she conducted her researches, her interests more generally, we assume that she must have, before she went to India in the first place, done some research into the Jewish communities of India, made inquiries, and perhaps made some contacts. But we suspect, again, there is no direct evidence for this, that already on that first trip she may have visited both Cochin and Bombay during that time. This was the first of a number of trips which were involved in research and the production of the film, a clip of which we're about to see. So it was largely thanks to that visit that she developed a deep and abiding interest in the Jews of India. And one of the major products of that interest was this film, 2,000 Years of Freedom and Honor, The Cochin Jews of India, which had its premiere showing at the Museum of Natural History right here in New York City in 1993. That's the introduction to the film, and we will now see the historical part of the film. So please do pay attention.
Wondrous, mystical India, Crepe was also haven for Western faiths, hospitable to Jews, Christians, Parsis, and Muslims. They lived in harmony in a land where all religions have been considered rivers flowing their separate ways into the ocean. A state in South India is a blessed, fertile land. Its inhabitants, the Malayalis, say the god who created Kerala had a green thumb. With 100 inches of rain annually, Kerala is covered with dense forests of teak, ebony, and rosewood. Most of India's ginger, rubber, coffee, tea, and coconut. The main staple of Kerala is rice, cultivated in rice paddies. Nature applies a coat of green twice a year, Rivers and backwaters provide easy communication and transportation. Safe in this bountiful land, a community of Jews has lived for two millennia. Honored and respected by their Indian hosts, they thrived. According to oral history, Jews arrived in Shingli, contemporary Kronganore, in 72 CE, soon after the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. The Hindu ruler received them graciously. In the 4th century, the Maharaja of Cochin gave them a principality with their own chief and a charter etched on copper plates, which granted them royal privileges in perpetuity and the remission of tolls and taxes for as long as the world and the moon exist. The favored status of the Jews may have had its origin in the lack of a trader merchant caste in Kerala. Jews, Christians, and Muslims filled the void. Lost their principality. They fled Kronganore and placed themselves under the protection of Kesava Rama Varma, the most celebrated ruler of the Portuguese period. He granted them, with a liberality that can hardly be understood, a site for a town by the side of his own palace and family temple. The Matanjeri Palace was built by the Portuguese in 1550. By the Dutch in 1555. Today it is a museum attracting scores of tourists. Jew Town was built in 1567 and the White Jew Synagogue called Pardesi in 1568. Palace and synagogue adjoin one another, separated only by a wall. The synagogue clock tower with Roman numbers face Synagogue Lane, and Hebrew numerals the Synagogue Yard. An ornamented gate leads from Jewtown to the palace. Between the two lay the garden where the Hindu princesses and Jewish ladies play. Portuguese rule of 160 years was the darkest period in Cochin history. Jew Town was sacked, the synagogue partly destroyed. The Jews regained their former glory and prosperity under the Dutch in the 17th century. Among the Jewish merchants was Ezekiel Rehabi, a diplomat and scholar, advisor to Kerala rulers. His house in Matanjeri, Jew Town, was a meeting place for princes and notables from India, Ceylon, Sumatra, China, and Arabia. Ezekiel Rehabi, an Orthodox Tamia, upon the request of the Syrian Christian Church of Malabar. Since the Middle Ages, the city of Cochin was a major harbor in India. The immense navigable canal connected the trade of Kerala with the Arabian Sea. Warehouses and mercantile firms along the harbor were busy with the world of trade. In the Dutch Raj period, trade was in the hands of Jerusalem, or Jerusalem, displayed a white Star of David on a red background. At least on two occasions, Jewish ships defended Cochin from invaders. In contrast to the bustling activities of the harbor, Fort Cochin is reminiscent of an old European town. Dutch and Portuguese architecture prevails, surrounded by green esplanades and gardens. In fact, the first European settlement in India was here. The first European church in India was also built in Cochin in 1510. Vasco da Gama was buried at his remains were later removed to Portugal. This church is one of the landmarks of Cochin, along with the royal palace and the Jewish synagogue. This is the mansion of Satu Kotar, the head of the seven Jewish communities in South India. He is also the historian of his people, Dutch consul, city councillor, and philanthropist. The Coders entertain guests for tea every afternoon in this immense room. Today it is empty. Children and grandchildren are in Israel. For holidays and festivals, Satu Kotar and family.
Okay.
Can we have the lights, please? You know, well, I have two things. First of all, technology always has its glitches.
Yes.
Right? The other thing is, there are many scholars in the audience. You all know that history always has its gaps. if you imagine this as the manuscript of the future, you now know what manuscript scholars have to do in order to create a full text of something. Fill in the gaps, and you get the basic idea, right? We're sorry, we'll have to check the technology for our next attempt. So what do we like to do now? Those of you who have been attending these library programs know that one of our great prides is to be able to connect the material that emerges from the archives and connects to various experiences and communities in the world that Johanna Spector studied to connect it with unique items in our collection. And I need not repeat, but I will anyhow, that our library has one of the most outstanding collections of rare Judaica in the world. I wish that the way we would do this would be to bring the originals down and be able to lay it out and provide you all the opportunity to see these materials, but A, they're very, very small, and B, they're very, very rare, and we make our top priority to protect these items so that they're not affected by poor climate and so forth. And so what we've done is to create a presentation based upon materials that are here in our rare book room. All I would say is if you have research interest that goes beyond merely seeing this, please make an appointment and come by, and you will have full access to the materials that you see here. In the meantime, though, I'm going to do a little bit of presentation and show you the kinds of things that reflect on the Indian Jewish experience that we have in our collection. This is the first. Let me provide you with a little bit of background here. Some of you may know a little bit about the Cairo Geniza. The Cairo Geniza is this amazing collection of materials that was accumulated over the course of nearly 1,000 years in the synagogue in Old Cairo. And because the community had in their mind, for reasons that we don't fully understand, that a holy Jewish document was not only a prayer book or a scroll that might be used in a mezuzah or a Torah scroll, for example, they seem to have believed that even Hebrew letters in and of themselves are holy. They put into their Geniza. Geniza is ordinarily a place for the temporary storage of sacred documents that have worn out. But they put into their collection, into their Geniza, anything that was written in Hebrew letters. And since they spoke Arabic but wrote their Arabic using Hebrew letters. This means that virtually anything that this Jewish community might be involved in was found in the Geniza. So what we've got here, as you can see, is identified for us as a letter from an Indian trader to his wife. This is in our collection. It's the discovery of the great Geniza scholar S.D. Goitein, who wrote a wonderful book on the evidence of Jewish traders during the Middle Ages based upon letters and business documents that are found in the Geniza. So this is one of those letters. It is, as you can see from, this is Goitein's estimation, from approximately 1204. From where you're sitting, you're not going to be able to see well enough to read this, though unless you read Judeo-Arabic, you wouldn't be able to read it anyhow. The first three lines are quotations from Scripture. So those are in Hebrew, and if you get close up, you would see that, for example, the third line is the quotation from the prophet, Nachamu, Nachamu, be comforted, be comforted. There is a sense of the community living in exile, and there is a possibility as well that this reflects the emotional state of the writer of this. This is a gentleman who has traveled from Egypt to India. Goitein estimates that the round trip without things getting in the way, right, just to go from Egypt to India, do your trading, and come back would have been at least 2 years. So needless to say, this was not going to be good for marital relations. And so this long letter, which goes on to the second side, includes a variety of details. First of all, I do have to say that what I'm going to be reading to you is Goitein's translation. He personalizes the translation. In other words, the man who's writing this, he knows is addressing his wife, so he has you, my dear, my beloved, things like that. If you look, though, at the Arabic, you'll see that he addresses third person masculine, because it's considered to be unseemly to write in a letter to speak directly to a woman, even your wife, because who knows who might open it and read it on its way from Egypt to India. I'm sorry, this case on its way from India to Egypt. And so you want to maintain a little bit of discretion. Goitein has changed that so it's clear that he's speaking to his wife. So what does he say? Just a little bit of the dynamic of this. This is a real window into the real life of Jews going between Egypt and India in the 13th century. And we know there was an enormous amount of trade of Jews between North Africa and India. If you think of the waterways mentioned before, the Arabian Sea was a very, very clear path between the two. So he writes, "In your letters, you alternatively rebuked and offend me," says the man writing to her, "or put me to shame and use harsh words all the time. I have not deserved any of this," he says to his wife. He goes on to say, "What you desire is what I so much desire, your legal rights on every Sabbath." That is an indirect reference to what? Anybody know legal rights every Sabbath? Marital relations, exactly. "I want the same thing," he says, right? "And on holidays, and to fulfill all of your wishes, great and small, with regard to dress and food or anything else. And you write to me as though I had forgotten about all of this." Evidently, she wasn't happy about his long trip. He spends a large part of the rest of the letter proclaiming his loyalty to her, that unlike other traders, right, over the course of this time, he remained loyal. He now goes on and says, "Now, if this is your wish, I cannot blame you, for the waiting has been long, and I do not know whether the Creator will grant relief immediately so that I can come home, or whether matters will take time, for I cannot come home with nothing. Therefore, I resolve to issue a writ," this is a writ of divorce, "which sets you free," but it's a conditional writ. He now goes on and says, "Now the matter is in your hand. if you wish separation from me, accept the bill of repudiation, that is to say the writ of divorce, and you are free. But he goes on to beg her not to act on this. This is only a small part of the letter, but it provides a very good sense of what real life was when you didn't have email to communicate, I guess, right? I mean, they traveled as much as we do. The only difference is we can actually be in touch when we're that far away. So that's the earliest piece of the evidence we have of the Indian Jewish community. We go on now. And this is much, much later, but very, very interesting. We're now in the 19th century, and this is, as you can see, a Haggadah, which was produced in Bombay in 1846 with Marathi translation. If you look up here, some of you will recognize that this is, anyone who's been involved in this community in recent years will recognize this name. This is the Halagua family. Right, who is part of, you know, behind the production of this, and you can see the word Cochin right here. So this is, the family is from Cochin. The Haggadah was, as I said, produced in Bombay. Now when we go to the next page here, you can see, comparing left to right, the left is obviously the one that I just showed you, the image on the right is the title page from the Amsterdam Haggadah of 1712. This is not a community that lived in isolation. The contacts with the West, with European civilization, were quite profound, and the influence of European civilization were profound as well. So this Jewish community, having come now back in contact with Jews of the West, relied upon some of that production in order to create their own materials. So you can see that the artist who created this, the words in Hebrew are different, but the imagery is the same, this copying this. What's going to be interesting is the way the copying of the Indian artist makes adjustments when we go on. The copy page leaves the images the same, but look at what happens later. So, I know that from the back this is going to be hard. I'll do a little bit of explaining so you can see. Here you've got, with the Marathi explanation, translation, the steps of the Seder, right? So Kadesh, or Chatz, Karpas, Yachatz, each of the steps of the Seder. And you can see that there are illustrations in each of these panels of what's being done there. So over here for Kadesh, the gentleman at the left of the table, who is clearly the person leading the Seder, is holding a cup of wine in his hand to illustrate the making of Kiddush. Over here you've got a man who seems to be a servant pouring water from a pitcher over the hands of the person leading the Seder. And so that's Orchatz. You make Kiddush and then you wash. And this goes on through the rest of these images. And then you've got the rest of them on the next pages. And I could show you quite directly how each one illustrates. But if we go back to the comparison, and again, I hope you can see this well enough just to get the general lineup here. The images here are copied from the images that go back to the very first richly illustrated Haggadah. This was a very influential Haggadah for the history of Haggadah illustration, Venice, 1609. And so if you can see well enough, if not, just pretend that you can see what I'm describing to you. Kadesh you've got up here with people around the table, and the person who's at the head of the table here, very much the same over here. The washing is right over here. Notice over here you've got someone at that same, you know, leaning forward and pouring from a pitcher. So the artist in India has copied as directly as we can imagine from here, but it's not a literal copying, because the dress in all of these pictures is not European dress. Right? It's the dress of Jews locally in India. There's one other element, though, which is very, very interesting and is worth paying attention to. So this goes back to, as I said, to Italy, 1609.
If you were closer, you would be able to see that at this table, literally in every picture, is at least one woman. That is to say, the woman of the household, the family. Right over here, she's on the corner. Then in the next pictures, she usually is sitting in the spot underneath the candelabra, or the middle, the light that provides. So each and every one of these, interestingly, if you look over, where is it? Right here is the second washing. And in the second washing, you can see that there's a crowd of people over here, a man at the front of the line washing his hands, followed by a group behind him, and the group includes a woman. If you go over to the left, you will find that every place there was a woman in the Venice Haggadah, it has become a man, quite demonstratively, usually with a beard, in the Indian Haggadah. Notice this one right here, the second washing, you can very easily see, even if you're probably further back, that there's only one person here, as opposed to the crowd over here. So the man at the front of the line has been preserved, and behind him, that crowd, which includes women, has been eliminated. You get a sense of what's considered to be culturally appropriate in the new cultural setting, because, right, we're going to see this in just a moment. This is Haggadah Pune, 1874. It's based also on the same artistic models, though with additions. And you can see here, unambiguously, that in the production of matzah, which is what's represented here, of course women are going to be involved in the production of matzah. That is culturally appropriate, unlike the shift in the sensibility of the artist who reflects the table of the Seder. I don't know, by the way, maybe somebody here does, whether this reflects any kind of historical reality, but the artistic reality is very, very powerful in terms of the decisions that are made. Of course, it's very obvious to see these are clearly Jewish women who were involved in the production of the matzot, and as you would expect, Jews in most cultures at most times have spoken the language of the local population, of the local culture, and of course when it comes to dress, right, we dress the same as our surroundings as well. That is the model which bears only very few exceptions. Here, this presentation was prepared by our librarian for special collections, Rabbi Jerry Schwartzbard, and he suggested the possibility here of a possible influence between these two. I confess that I don't see it. In the others, it's perfectly clear, but you are all welcome to make that judgment for yourself. This goes back, this is still in the Pune Haggadah. This is based again on the Amsterdam model that we saw earlier. This is the first panel of that, Kadesh, making Kiddush. There's another adjustment here. Not only has the woman been replaced by a man with a long beard, but they've changed the furnishings as well. In the first creation of this back in Bombay, the lamps were the same lamps as were used in the European model. Here the style of the lamps has been changed to the local model to more accurately reflect what this experience would have been in this community. Now, we do have in our collection available to researchers a number of ketubot that really are beautiful reflections of the community. Indian ketubot, at least I should say, illuminated or illustrated Indian ketubot, are relatively speaking late. If we go to Europe, we go to Italy or a variety of other communities, they go back a century or two before this. This is amongst the earliest of the surviving ketubot, at least from Cochin, although there are textual ketubot that are earlier. They're simply not illustrated. This already, there are two pieces here that are worth paying careful attention to. And actually, before I say that, I want to thank our good friend, Benjamin Zucker, who is a collector of ketubot and other things. And he has deposited his tuba collection here in our collection. He owns that collection, but he's been kind enough to make it available to researchers here, so I want to give him our thanks and credit for this. In any case, this kind of architectural structure surrounded by the flora and the birds up here is very, very typical on the Indian Ketubot. More generally, there are some differences depending upon which of the communities that you're in. Ketuba, for those of you, I should have filled this in, is the Jewish marriage contract, protecting the interests of the woman at the time of getting married. A couple of things here are particularly worth noting. You've got two panels here. The ketubah, meaning the specific conditions of agreement between the woman and the man getting married, are in the bottom panel here. You'll notice that there's a big empty space. They don't worry about filling it in, as is often the case in other kinds of Jewish legal documents. That's distinct and noteworthy. It's written in a local script. Unlike the local script, you've got a standard dedicatory formula, and you can see how long it is here up at the top. Visually, it's also worth noting the hands at the top that tells us that the family that's involved in the marriage here is?
Kohanim.
Right, Kohanim, priest. You will also see up here what looks sort of like a bowl, I guess. It's hard to make out because the ketubah is actually cut at the top. By analogy to other ketubot, we know that this is a crown, probably the crown of the British Empire. This is very typical in these ketubot. It begins with the phrase, B'Shem Rahman Malei Rachamim, in the name of the Rahman, of the merciful one who is filled with mercy. There is some speculation among scholars, a powerful influence from the Muslim community going west. Many of you know that the Muslim dedicatory formula is the Bismillah, B'Shem Allah, in the name of God, who is merciful and does mercy. This emphasis on mercy may well be due to the influence of the broader Muslim culture. Here, just the line which shows us that it's a Kohen. How am I doing time-wise?
We have 7 minutes.
Okay, good. So I'm approaching the end. Perfect. So here you get a little bit closer, but again, you can contrast the nature of the writing. And then, in a very happy coincidence, years after the fact, again, credit is due to Benny Zucker, you're going to have, you'll see here in a moment, two ketubot. These from Bombay, the first one from 1897. And you can see that this is a very simple, not illustrated, merely the text, although again, it is separated by the standard long dedicatory formula speaking of love, God's mercy, and all of the rest. You can see B'Shem Rahman. And then you've got the standard part of the ketubah. Interestingly, you'll note that there is a different kind of writing. Spaces have been left, right? So one part of this is produced by a professional scribe, and the other part is filled in, as we often do with prepared ketubot. We fill in at the appropriate places. It tells us here that this is in the place called Bombay. That can easily be read here. Interestingly, if you read into it, you can see that the person writing didn't actually understand the formula of the ketubah. He puts in words that don't belong there. And those very same words are repeated a little bit later on. It reflects in a certain way on the literacy of the community. But you can see this. It just so happens that the woman to whom this ketubah was delivered, and the important thing to know about ketubah practice is, again, it's to protect the interests of a woman at a wedding, and the rule is, give it to the woman and it will protect her. And if she doesn't have it anymore, she's in trouble. And so rabbinic law forbids a woman to remain in the same house as her husband if she loses her ketubah. Lo and behold, this ketubah was lost. Okay? And so, 2 years later, you've got the very same people, their names reflected in a Nuke tuba with exactly the same formulation, the same introduction, the same text of the tuba, but 2 years later on. Evidently, right, the first one was lost. Obviously, they couldn't recover it. Benny Zucker identified, having had this one first, he found the original one. Right, so the lost ketubah was found many, many decades later. I'm sorry, we have to save questions to the end just because of the time pressures. You will note that this is not a particularly, associations of the structures here and so forth are distinctly non-Indian, whichever of the communities you might locate. Again, this relates to the trade and influence between Europe and India at this time. And very, very interestingly, look carefully at this and now the next image, and you can see the ketubah on the right, which is given all of the empty spaces here. You see this is a printed ketubah, which leaves open the spaces that you will fill in order to specify it for that particular wedding. That's not why we're showing it to you. But you can see that aside from the division that's been made here, in order to preserve the tradition of Indian ketubot that has the formula at the top and then the text of the ketubah at the bottom, but the architectural framing obviously is identical. Very, very unusual. You'll notice at the top the putai, right? The little naked angels, right? This is unheard of in the art of the broader Muslim sphere, and the otherwise the ketubot reflect that more than any other influence. This is influenced by that, the star at the top. We do have actually models for the entire top structure that come from other kinds of European documents in Amsterdam and elsewhere. It won't surprise anyone to know that the crown in those alternatives, but which serve as direct models, all have crosses. So to use this for a Jewish document, the crosses have been eliminated. You may be able to see that the other thing that has been eliminated here is the letters in the Star of David. I don't know whether that is knowing or not, except that this ketubah from Amsterdam says Kuf Aleph, and it goes around. Kuf Aleph means Kehilat Ashkenaz, right? The community of Ashkenaz, Ashkenazi community. Obviously, that's inappropriate over here. So did they knowingly remove it or just simply remove the letters? That we don't know, but the influence is unmistakable. And that is what you might see, or at least part of what you might see, if you're interested in the rare materials that we preserve in our collection from the Indian Jewish communities. Thank you.
From the rest of the world Jewry, with the fact that once they arrived in India with this very difficult kind of a shipwreck and had lost all their religious books, their religious practices were based on only three things: Shabbat, Kashrut, and Brit Milah. They kept Kashrut completely, they kept Shabbat to the large extent possible, and they were continuing the Brit Milah. There was no contact between the Ben Israels who landed here with the shipwreck with the world Jewry. They lost contact for centuries.
निकलना बेंजामिन वास्क संबंध अपना रहता है वही अभी अपने ज्यूस ज्यादा नहीं है
there are as it is very few Jews there but there are quite a number of Jews we live as we are they live as they are and we can't follow their practices but we live together
थोड़ा बहुत में जाना तो पड़ता ही है ना
we do go for their functions when they have them they come for our functions so it is also our obligation to go for their functions yet we do not participate in it if it is contradictory to our religion but we do show our presence very well
my name is Ilan Benjamin Vaskar mera favorite game hai cricket Allah namaz bol Allah
I like to come to the synagogue because I love to pray I love to put money in the charity box and to light memorial candles
My name is Jacob. My father's name is Elijah. My surname is Dandekar. You are
It's a general feeling that they hold towards God, that they show empathy and respect towards us. Even on Simchat Torah, to decorate the Simcha, we receive fruits from them. Ultimately, it is an act to God. If we receive an invitation, we do go for their functions. The relations are The relations are good, but in the village of Pain, which is around 30 kilometers from here, there is a bit of crossing. Means, like once when I went to cut some goats for a festival, so they asked me, "Am I Yehudi?" And I said, "Yes." Then they told me that we don't have goats for you. Please go back.
Robin Vaskar. Prashna manje pahile log hote na june.
The Jews that were there before, what work would they do? On each ghani that they call the oil producing machine, there used to be a bull that did the rotating and they used to take it in a sort of a box and take it to sell.
Only when the Cochin Jews got the news about this community. They even not were called Jews. David Rahabi, one of the rabbis from Cochin, came to Bombay and observed these people and particularly followed the women when they went to the bazaars, to the markets, to buy fish. And he observed that they did not buy any meat. They only bought fish which had fins and scales. That means they were very particular about keeping kashrut. And when he followed them to the home, they saw that they were not mixing that with any milk. They had some vessels which were separate. And so those observations caught his attention and he started to give them teachings on the religious aspects. And these community members picked up and they became more observant. And that's how their revival started to take place. Thereafter, the Baghdadi community came in the early 19th century from Baghdad and as we all know they also came from a very difficult situation during Daud Pasha's rule which was very difficult rule so they escaped from there
I'm the caretaker for Magen David Synagogue I'm one of the Iraqi Jews my father and mother they were from Baghdad I was born over there I live in Bombay now for several years I look after the Magen David Synagogue
and the leader of that community one of the members was David Sassoon and he came actually escaping the decree of Daud Pasha to hang him he was told go to India and you will make fortune and it so happened that he was called the Rothschild of the East he established several businesses and was very close to the British and he gave a lot of encouragement to religious aspects of the community established synagogues established community centers all that happened in 19th and 20th century beginning so that was a second revival for the Bene Israel community as well recently We have seen some marriages taking place between the Baghdadi and the Bene Israel Jews. Bene Israel and Cochin Jews. A cousin of mine got married to a Cochin Jew. So there is some interaction, but largely the Bene Israels are now predominant in the community. Out of the 5,000 Jews all over India, more than 4,700 are the Bene Israel Jews. 250 are the Baghdadi Jews, and remaining 50 are the Cochin Jews.
My name is Moshe Yosef Rajpurkar. They are at Kurla in Bombay city. There was no discrimination. There was no discrimination. All children were treated alike because the municipal school is meant for children from all castes and communities. Yeah, I had a Hindu friends, I had a Muslim friends, as well as Jewish friends. Formerly we used to play mostly cricket, then Indian games. Our tendency was to say that we are Indian first and Jews afterwards. There was one association known as Bombay Zionist Association, and I was a member of that association. They used to conduct several lectures in synagogues, school halls, and I used to go for the lectures. There were different opinions, but majority were for the Zionism. We are requesting our community members from Kurla and nearby places to come to prayer on Saturdays. And we do get, I'm happy to say that we do get Minyan on first Saturday of English calendar month.
My name is Yaya Jirar. Even though we lived in India, we didn't really traditionally fall into the Hindu patterns of, say, probably caste system or family values. So even though certain norms we had to grow up as being Indian, but we still followed our identity of running our families the way we felt was right. So if it came to education, so they, like, we gave our girls equality as much as we gave the male child. So that was again different from the Hindu setup. Probably that was at Jewish values. Probably our way back then, our proximity or our working conditions with the British, with which our grandparents and great-grandparents worked with, and then the education, probably that made us different, probably not following the very typical trend of the traditional Hindu setup. And there were things like probably the mobile creches, what I know of, like an Indian Jewish woman started this mobile creche for the children on the construction sites years ago. She started it off from a little van, and then now it's a large movement. So it reached out to everybody, but it was her creation. Many people are they Indian, are they Jewish? But no, I'm very sure who I am. And I'm very comfortable in whatever setup I go in whichever Jewish community I am in. I know I'm Indian. For years we have lived in India, so I have certain values, and my growth has been with an Indian ethics and values, but I very strongly adapt to my Jewish identity, and I think my name keeps that thing alive in me all the time, is Yael.
My name is Nathaniel Girard. I see myself as a Jew living in India with a strong foundation in India. Since it's important to keep the heritage alive, keep our synagogues running, I think there's a need to bringing the Jewish youth into a direct link with the main center of Jewish life, that is the synagogue. I think the way arranged marriages happen, it increases the probability and chances of a boy and a girl meeting, because it's not only you who's looking out, it's also your father, your mother, your brothers, sisters, your uncles, aunts, and all your extended family, and the so-called matchmakers in the community who want to make a certain union happen.
The Bene Israels chose to live near Muslim neighborhoods. Reason was very obvious, that they did not want to disturb the sentiments of the Hindu community, as Jewish people ate kosher meat. Hindus don't even touch meat. But we also eat the local Hindu
food which is called Purim Poli, which they make it exactly on the Purim day for their festival called Holi. Now that adaptation is to express to them our tolerance, our acceptance of their culture into our culture. But we did not encourage our children to marry their children. One or two marriages here and there may have taken place, but in principle the Jewish value system inside the home was very dominant, and outside the home there was a tolerance and acceptance of other cultures.
Well, I feel that the Indian society as a whole, which Muslims are part of, are very tolerant towards Jews in India, because they perceive Jews to be Indians first, you see.
The Bene Israel Jews were given prominent positions in the British Army. They were majors, lieutenant colonels, colonels, also generals in the British Army. Why? The Jews had, first of all, little foreign origin. They were not local. British found that as an advantage to control the local, because Bene Israels understood the local situation as well as they had characteristics of being foreign. So the Jewish people flourished during the British Raj. Naturally, there was certain loyalty, and in fact, the first Bene Israel synagogue was built by one of the members of the Bene Israel community who worked for the British Army. Majority were comfortable with the British Raj because that's where their jobs were. There was a certain amount of people who had the interest in the freedom movement. So they were supporting that. In 1948, 14 youth from the Bene Israel community left for Israel with a dream to settle and build a new nation. Some of them continued to remain there, and many of them, their dream was shattered. They didn't realize that Holy Land was nothing but rocks, no roads, villages, and they decided to return back. They wrote to the then Prime Minister of India, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, who allowed them to come back. So that was the Zionism's initial movements. Currently, out of India is largely in Israel, and they number almost 100,000. Then we have some number of few hundred in Australia, in Europe, in North America, and other parts of the world.
I now want to introduce Peter Geffen. Asher is
Isabel
and William.
We have one more chair.
Yes, we need.
Okay.
Peter, do you want to stand or sit?
I'll start standing and we'll all sit.
Okay.
You know, the people in the back would really love the air conditioning back. What happened? Naomi? Huh? No, it just... Oh, you didn't intentionally turn it off?
No, we didn't.
Open this door to get some fresh air?
This is to a closet.
It'll be like, you know what this is? This is like being in India.
I knew there was a way to say it.
In the winter. Okay, so I want you to have an opportunity to hear from these wonderful college students, their experience, and get a perspective from them about what this magnificent country of India is, and what this very special Jewish community is that I think you got a flavor of in this video by our dear friends Ralphie and Yael, and this, and although one son was invisible and quiet, I'll tell you about him in a moment. But I'll introduce this in a little way. But the first thing I'd like to know is how many of you have been to India? So you see, it's so interesting, right? A crowd like this, the people who come out are not the people who've never been to India, but the people who've been to India. So that's great. So then you know that whatever we tell you is inaccurate, because you obviously know more and had much better sources. So we'll start off with the fact that we'll work from there. The program that these students were on brought them to India, called Kivunim, is takes a moment to explain, only because it sets a particular way in which to understand really this whole evening, and maybe in retrospect the experience that some or all of you had while being in India. Kivunim is based upon a very simple notion that over the course of the last several generations, American Jewish education has lost almost entirely its touch with Jewish history and the Jewish people. We use these terms, particularly Jewish people, as a truism on an ongoing basis. We speak about the Jewish people this and the Jewish people that, and in reality, we ourselves, adults, teachers, and certainly our children and students, know virtually nothing about the Jewish people all over the world in any real sense. And the thing that we teach that is highly simplistic is that our story is basically a story of preserving ourselves by keeping ourselves separate in one way or another from everyone who was around us. So Kivunim is based upon the opposite premise. We want our students to understand that the Jewish people is who it is and what it is because of the unique integration, if you will, in this holy institution, positive assimilation within and from and pushing back into the many cultures and civilizations within which we have lived over the course of decades, centuries, and millennia. And therefore, when we travel, we study about the broader culture of the 12 countries that we go to on an annual basis, and we experience in those countries and in our study the Jewish experience. But we do not go on what I proverbially call the Bubby's tour, in which we visit synagogues, cemeteries, and if there are kosher restaurants, and then go home. Because the only way to really understand the story is, in our view, to understand the totality of the experience. And we travel each year to Greece, to Macedonia, to Bulgaria, to Morocco, to Portugal, to Spain, to Turkey, to Hungary, to the Czech Republic, to Germany, and to India. And India, I would say, without any question, is almost always the most powerful experience. First of all, because it's so very different, because it is so culturally powerful, and of course because it opens your senses in every respect. Since the vast majority of people who are in this room have been to India, you know exactly what I'm talking about. In every respect, you cannot leave India the same person that you were when you came in. You're forced to encounter this very remarkable different culture. Just to give you a flavor of that, and then I'm going to hand this over with a couple of questions to our students. We have a wonderful teacher who actually passed away this year for our students about Hinduism. His name was Basu, Dadaji, as he was known by honorific. And whenever Kivunim comes to Varanasi, this wonderful man was our teacher. The first time that we met, I wanted to give him a gift after spending 2 days with him. He was a remarkable human being. What was I going to give him? A check, a bill, some silly token? I said, Dada, you know, we run Kivunim, at that time was still running a teacher program every summer. Have you ever been to Israel? I'd love to invite you to come on our teacher program. He said, oh, Peter, when I was a student, I studied the kibbutz, and I wrote my dissertation on the kibbutz, but I've never been. I would love to come. Okay, so he came to Israel. So he's an older man. We're in Israel. When we were moving around, I would take him as many places as possible with a car. One day, the group is going down to the Western Wall at night, but earlier in the day, I wanted him to see the whole scene, so I drove him in the car in through the Jaffa Gate, which you still could do then, and we were driving along the road past the Yeshivat Porat Yosef, and you look out as you begin to see the mosque on your left-hand side, you see the beautiful village of Silwan on the right, and I said to him, Dadaji, isn't it beautiful, the village, you know, the way it meshes into the color of the mountains, and he looked at me and he said, but Peter, where is the color? Where is the color? Because in India, you know, there's no such thing. What was no interest in a sand-colored space? It was just a complete nothing. So I myself have often wondered how it is that I have never had the sense, I may be inaccurate, but I have never had the sense of seeing any Indian woman dressed with the same combination of cloth in her sari that the next woman was wearing. Now, it's impossible, right? You have 250 million people in India, half of whom approximately are women, that can't possibly be all wearing different cloth. But nonetheless, the sensation of color is so dramatic. It's so powerful. So this is a piece of culture, and it's an important and powerful one. So what I asked our students to do in trying to bring their experience as younger people to you to sort of push this evening's program beyond the historic and into the present was, first of all, to share something that they themselves remembered very distinctly from one or another experience in the country. And from there, we'll move in a few other directions. We had a preliminary conversation. This is not completely, you know, unrehearsed, but it's really unrehearsed. But I wanted them to share something of their own experience, and then we'll move on a little bit from there. So let's start, since you're next to me. Asher, go ahead.
Okay. So when Peter asked us that question, there were really two things that came to mind that really stood out for me when we were in India as part of our experience. And the first was that one of the places that we visited while in India was Dharamsala, which is up in the mountains where the Tibetan government in exile actually lives. And we got a chance to talk with several of the monks there and talk with them sort of about being Jewish and their sort of experience being a culture that is currently in exile. And we really had this incredible conversation talking about how being Jewish, this is something that we've had to live with for many generations, being a community and a religion that has survived in exile. And the Tibetan government and the Tibetan people is a very new community in the exile and in the world sort of out of their homeland and in a place that is not where their community is built on originally. And one of the interesting sort of dualities of that was that they were in India, a place that is so accepting and so open to different religions and cultures, which is somewhere where the Jewish community there has also thrived for a long period of time. And so it was very interesting to talk to them about that and to sort of see that that is something that the Jewish community has had to live with that we don't often think about just on our daily lives in this world, in practicing our Judaism in the place that we do, but that for that we have really been a community outside of our homeland for so many years.
I just want to add a quick little thing that's for the seminary. So you'll report that I did something positive for the seminary in this talk.
By being here, you're doing something.
Yes. So when we were in Dharamsala a few years ago, we went to visit a residential school for Tibetan children because there are tens of thousands of children who come across the ceiling of the world, as it's called, and make their way without their parents and without their families. And they're being raised in residential communities, very much like the children's villages that were built in Israel for Holocaust survivors. Beautiful communities. So we went to pay a visit, and we were sitting around talking with the director, and he said, so who are you people? So Rabbi Dov Luria and I introduced ourselves and, you know, said that that we were Jews from the United States mostly. And he said, oh,
I just spent last summer in Kemp Ramah in the Berkshires, because this is the head of the, you know, the whole network of Tibetan schools in India. Why? Because the administration of the Tibetan government had decided that they needed to understand how you preserve a second culture within a majority culture, because they're struggling with this issue. And so the world is very small.
When Peter asked us this question, one moment particularly stood out in my memory. We spent Shabbat in Delhi, and it was... So we spent Shabbat in Delhi, and it was a small group. It was us on Kibunim and some of the local community. And the building was pretty modern, so it didn't seem so unusual. It was rather familiar. And I remember sitting in services, and I looked back at the door as a couple was entering, and one of the people was this very old woman in a traditional sari. It was beautifully draped and decorated. And as she walked through the door, she reached up to kiss the mezuzah, and she was so short that she had to actually stand on her tiptoes and reach her arm all the way up to kiss the mezuzah. And for some reason, that image just really stuck in my memory, and I remember writing about it in my journal a few days later. And I think why it was so striking was because of its familiarity, while also contrasted with something, an environment that I found unusual because I was not experienced with it. So for the past week before that, we had spent so much time being surrounded by a language that I couldn't understand and seeing people dressed in a completely unfamiliar way, which was really, I only recognized because of kind of classic images that I had of Indian culture that you get from movies and literature, mainly associated with the dress because that's very distinctive. And that all seemed very foreign to me. And then to see this woman who was completely immersed in this Indian culture, but at the same time doing a movement that was so familiar to me and to so many of us. I for a lot of people, it's like a reflex to kiss the mezuzah as you walk through the door. And I think just that combination was really, it was really profound, because such differences can also exist in the community based on where the community has developed, such as India or America. But at the same time, there are these elements that either have been preserved as the same, or because of some cross flow, they have developed similarly. And that was a really interesting moment, and it was pretty meaningful to see that.
My only commentary is that it's striking in India how open the Jewish community is to adopting practices like challah on Shabbat that come from the West and from outside. Whereas we, as you may know, are very uptight about anything that crosses any border, you know, Sephardi to Ashkenazi and Reform to Conservative. We're really, these things get us very distressed. And what you find in India is a wide open kind of acceptance. This is what is practiced by Jews over here. This is an interesting thing. And it covers everything. So we had Shabbat. We had Shabbat dinners, which were, for me, a disappointment each year, because they looked like our Shabbat dinner here at the seminary. William.
All right, so...
Stand up, then.
Sure. So it's been a few years, so I had to sort of reach back into my memory and think about what really has stuck with me. But for me, it was a day in Pune. Knowing the presentation, there was some reference to the Pune Haggadah. And I'll start by saying that we went to India at the very end of our year. It was the last thing that we did on the trip. And so by that point, we had seen Jewish communities all over the world. We had been to Morocco, we had been to Hungary, to Spain. And so at that point, seen a lot of synagogues, a lot of weird places. So it was going to take a lot to really wow me.
and a lot of my friends. But we show up in Pune, and it's the quintessential Indian scene. Get off the bus, cows walking through the streets. I never even heard of this city. Hours away from Mumbai, very rural area. And so I'm thinking, okay, maybe we're going to see an old synagogue. I know the Bene Israel had been here before. We had seen places in other parts of the world, in Morocco, for example, where what was so amazing was how well preserved the synagogue was, that there was some sort of local keeper who had guarded it. But here, the day was actually Lag BaOmer, and we walk up to the synagogue. There's a Magen David on the door. Door opens, and the place is packed with people, Indian people, women wearing saris. The men were wearing kippot, and they were all there for this huge Lag BaOmer celebration. So they really had quite a turnout. And behind us, there was sort of this cacophonous sound, and there was a wedding going on, and the groom was riding a horse through the street, and there's a whole parade going by for this wedding. So it's really just a crazy scene. And the reason I sort of paint that picture is just to show how the extent to which this synagogue was immersed in the surroundings, and their customs were as well. To walk in, there's a courtyard, and then to walk inside the synagogue building itself, everyone had to take their shoes off, which is something that's completely foreign for most people. And then on top of that, they had a special ceremony for Lag BaOmer, and it was, I don't really know exactly how to describe it, but everybody was sort of sitting outside of the synagogue. There was this extra level of sanctity to walking inside the synagogue. Everyone was outside the synagogue. And they had this platter of fruits that was being offered to Eliyahu. And it was this really unique ceremony that I'd never seen before. But I mean, what was the reason this really sticks with me is it's just absolutely insane, really, how very Indian this scene was and how very Indian the synagogue was. And it just shows, as Peter was talking about, sort of the theme of Kibbunim, that they had this really positive assimilation with their surroundings, but they were still Jewish and were still celebrating Lag BaOmer. So.
Now, I will just add a funny incident with this that indicates the degree of cultural ignorance that people like me bring to the scene. So this scene, that when William described this, so I remembered what happened that day, which was, In front of the doorway of the synagogue, there's this big platter. I think it was vegetables. You think it was fruit. Maybe it was fruit and vegetables. But at the very top of this platter were things that looked like sprouts. That's very important. At a certain point, the leading member of the community, who is not a rabbi, but is their moel, and told me the number of circumcisions that he had, what did he do?
Performed,
that's it. Sounds like the wrong word, but in any case, yes. And he was leading this ceremony. There was a whole four-page book of liturgy, all in Hebrew, surrounding the idea that this had something to do with Eliyahu Hanavi. I couldn't follow exactly what the direction was, but it was clear Eliyahu Hanavi was a big force in this. And they get to a certain point, and he picks up the sprout, and he says a bracha. So I am not paying much attention. I'm hungry. So I take a sprout as well, because if he's taking a sprout, I'll take a sprout. He's saying a bracha, so then we're going to eat this. So I think he's saying, Borei, okay, Borei Pri Adama. But that's not what he's saying. He is saying, Borei, Mine besamim, spices.
Oh.
But I pop.
Oh, chili.
They weren't chili, but they were not to be eaten. And this entire crowd that William is talking about looks at this silly American who has just eaten the spices that were supposed to be passed around for everybody to smell. And you know what's interesting is that if this happened in certain countries in the world of a certain extraction with a certain religious orientation, they would have picked me up and taken me outside, and you know that would be the end of it. But here everybody just laughed and went on, which was really very charming. So now my next question, we don't have a lot of time, but my next question is, if you were to think back upon something which, now beyond a memory, something which really sort of strikes you with impact upon as a cultural phenomena that you saw or experienced that is not common to us. Do you have something like that in your memory, like Isabel?
So I really like this question, as Peter insinuated, because I wrote my final paper on Kibunim about, I focused on Passover rituals and exploring differences between so-called like pure elements of Judaism, which I defined as being directly related to text in the Torah, and elements that were more directly influenced by local traditions that just became traditions because of the local culture. And that's a very fluid topic, and I'm sure that my paper could have been much better than it was then. But something that I discovered while researching was a custom in India during Passover where community members actually put their hands in the blood of the Passover sacrifice and either make a handprint on a paper which they hang over their doors or actually make a handprint on their doors to reference the Passover sacrifice. And that, when I was researching this, I was like, wow, I've never heard of this. It seems a little bit, I guess, unusual. I had a hard time believing that this was really true, even though I did trust the source I was reading this from. So I wrote my whole paper, and then we get to India, and we went to a little village a few hours outside of Mumbai, and I think it was Alibag, but I'm...
It was.
Okay, it was Alibag. And we walked into a synagogue, and in the courtyard right outside the synagogue, I actually see one of these handprints up on the door. And that was a really cool moment for me because, first of all, yay, Kibunim's purpose is working. I researched something and then I saw it in person. But also it was just...
Exactly.
I was just astounded to see that something I had learned about was actually there, and also that this tradition exists, which is something that you would never see here, and it just seems so strange, but there it was a very distinct and integral part of their Passover observance, and that was probably the most culturally distinct phenomenon that I experienced in India, and I thought it was really cool.
Either of you?
Nothing.
Go ahead. No? No. William?
No.
So, in a moment, I'd like you to ask some questions, but I want to just, because we're on a very tight schedule here, and not clearly not enough time, but you maybe will allow people who want to ask questions and and stay in the schwitz to be able to do so. Maybe. But I wanted to make sure that that everyone, including those who have been to India but who may not have gone in a context which would give you the Jewish historical experience, to understand just a few things that were referred to in Ralphie Girard's film. First of all, I just want to tell you, you know this very charming woman, Yael, right? You liked her? Mm-hmm. Right? So she's this really remarkable woman. This is Ralphie's wife and Nathaniel's mother. So you should know that this year on Kibunim, we have their younger son on our program for the year. And it's really quite an amazing thing because on the one hand, he's now just another kid like anybody else. But on the other hand, he was coming from a very different world. His parents were married by a shadchan. And as you may not have fully understood, Nathaniel was explaining to you why he and his brother Avniel are in all likelihood going to also agree to have their wives chosen by someone outside in this world. And these are boys who encounter and know the Western world, and they are not ultra-Orthodox. These are very modern, very much like conservative Jews. Are conservative Jews still considered modern? Oh, good. Okay. So you know, so these are very unique people. But the film also referred to the origin of the community. So the mythology
again, I guess I have to be careful with language, not only with the scholars, but also with the laity and with the members of the Indian community who are here. The mythology, the accepted mythology of the origin of the B'nai Israel is that there was trouble in the Middle East or somewhere, maybe even Yemen. There was a group who got on a ship with all their belongings and sailed east. When that ship reached the shores of India, a few hours by car today, south of Mumbai, there was a gigantic storm. We're talking about approximately 2nd century BC. The ship shipwrecked, everything was destroyed, and only a few people survived. And when they came ashore, the local people asked them, "Who are you?" And they said, "We are B'nai Israel." And so they called them B'nai Israel. Then they said, "Well, what do you do?" And they said, "We grow lentils and we press olive oil." So they called them Shamwarteli, the olive pressers who observe the Sabbath day. And that became the name of their caste. And that caste is what really preserved the Jewish people. And I remember going to Israel for the first time in 1964, which was the year that the majority, the big community of Indian Jews came to Israel. And initially, of course, the Rabbanut wanted to refuse them status as Jews and make them convert to Judaism. And they sat in tents, outside the Rabbanut's offices in Jerusalem. And by the end of 1964, uniquely after what we've seen in recent years, they were actually accepted fully without any condition. And the main reason for that was because what Ralphie told you, the observance of Shabbat, Kashrut, and Brit Milah, but also because the caste system, combined with a few other rules that they had about how they would marry or not after divorce or death of spouses, etc., meant that their integrity was preserved in the view of the Rabbanut almost intact. And therefore, they were accepted into the corpus of the Jewish people, for better or for worse, without the kind of embarrassment and humiliation that has taken place with several other immigrant communities. And it's a remarkable, it is a remarkable universe, this universe of the Indian Jew. A very powerful integration that we experience when we come on year after year. And you know, the film, when you're looking at Joanna's pictures of Cochin, so today there's probably one, I think he's still left, one man. That's it. There's nobody. And in Mumbai, or in several of these other synagogues, where you saw whole groups of people, so a community is very small, very, very different, very diminished. But the nature of the culture is both remarkable and a testimony to the power of integration. The person who teaches our course to our students is a professor at the Hebrew University named Shalva Weil. She's one of the world's experts on Indian Jewry. And Shalva calls her lecture, "India, the Consecration of Tolerance," because there has never been anti-Semitism in India. And in all of this time, over 2,000 years, it is remarkable. Some people today think that the incident that occurred with the Pakistanis, the terrorists, was anti-Semitism. It may have been anti-Semitism, but it came from the Pakistanis. It didn't come from Indians. And you need to think about it, because Jews lived in villages with Hindus and Muslims. And you can go today throughout this whole area of Ali Bagh, where the Jews first came, and see many different synagogues, all of which are preserved by non-Jews, by Hindus, who just do so in order to protect this religious tradition, of which not only do they have no part, but they have no people to even see. It's really quite something. So it's an honor and privilege. So what I think we should do is, anybody who has any questions, you can ask those questions, but anybody who has to go home should go home, and we'll stay a little bit, and please direct the questions to these guys, because they really know a lot more than anybody else here, certainly than me. Yes, it won two.
This is directed to you, not to them. Don't take offense. I knew Johanna Spector, Dr. Johanna Spector, very well. She lived two blocks from here. And she was very much, I traveled to India with her as well. She had a great passion for India. And academically, her study of the music, the liturgy, the liturgical music, specifically of Kuchi, as well as the pronunciation of Hebrew, her articles on that are really major breakthroughs in that. She loved the seminary with a passion. She had no family. Her family was right here, this building. And as you said, the archives are from her, and that's why you're here tonight. And her library is here. Her bank account was here. She asked one thing. She asked that when she died, since she had no family basically, is that the seminary take care of her funeral, which was fair. They didn't do it, which is unfortunate. So I think that before we leave, that you should say Kaddish for her. We'll all stand and you should say Kaddish for her. She deserves it.
Very nice.
There was a memorial service.
There was a memorial service?
Yeah, there was.
When was that?
Not even after her dying.
Uh-huh. Okay, questions? Yes.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's the balance between the preservation of the local Jewish theme, narrative, and the harmonization of the Jewish, what's left through, you know, some elements of that. Anyway, that's a comment from Nathaniel Girard. We had an amazing visit with him and his family in Kuchin, and one of the comments that he made, we had our ways of doing the synagogue here. When Chabad came to India, they said, you don't look Jewish to me. Let me show you, I mean, those that probably look the most Jewish, going back 2,000 years, you don't look, let me show you how to do it. And basically, they took over.
Huh.
And you know, I know when Michal was there, she taught Hebrew in the synagogue to many of these Jewish women with the sari. But as you go around and you have the same experiences in other culture, is sort of, what's the balance, as you see, between the preservation of what's left and the harmonization of the way things are? Sort of, there's one way of doing it, and sort of the local experiences, the local culture, you know, disappear, even if they exist a little bit.
I can talk for a minute on this. I think it's a very tough thing to find a balance of. I mean, throughout the year that we were on Kivunim, we were trying to find a balance of doing this. When we were in synagogues in Morocco, where people hadn't been for several, you know, generations, nobody had ever used these places, and then we came in and we were trying to sort of use them in our sense of Judaism, but trying to also understand what Judaism was practiced in these places for generations before us. I don't think it's ever an answer of, you know, I don't think there is an answer. I think the best thing that we can do is try and understand the historical nature and what these cultures have been doing for generations and where their historical practices come from. And look at those in both the context of the community that they're in and the traditional sort of Jewish communities that have interacted with them from outside, in sort of what you were saying, the harmonious. Because, I mean, as we saw from the as we saw from the Haggadah that we were looking at before, that even though these communities here have been independent and they have created their own traditions and culture, intermixed with the Indian community at large, they've throughout history had interactions with the Western Jewish world and had influences from those worlds. And I think one of the best things that Peter told us when we started Kivunim is that you had to go into this experience with an open mind. You can't go in here saying, this is how I do this, this is the best way to do it, and I'm gonna go and try and judge and understand from my perspective what's going on. But you have to look at each of these communities as from a very open perspective and say that they have their own history and they have their own reasons that they've come to this point that they are. And so it's hard when you have a community coming in and trying to change and say, you know, this is how you do Judaism, because that's not what this is all about. It's, you know, they do Judaism and this is their connection to the religion that's been built on their community and their relationship with their local surroundings. And so I don't think there's a good answer there, but I think it's important to understand the history behind it.
Anybody else?
Okay. I just have a small add-on, is that yes, there are instances where other cultures maybe superimpose or share their practices with a different community, but I think that necessarily there are adjustments made to integrate those practices into the local community. And a good example was what was mentioned earlier with the changes in the dress and of the pictures and the way things looked. That was clearly taken from a different interpretation of Judaism, but it was modified to make sense to the way that people were living their lives in India. So I think that that is part of this balance that always happens, even if ideas and beliefs are sort of shared or moved from one culture to another. There are always these slight modifications that are intrinsic to whatever the local community is.
I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Given the hour, will anyone who'd like to ask questions, please feel free to come up. I just want to end by saying, first of all, to thank Naomi for having organized this program. Thank Hector, who you'll find in the rear, who has helped us with this and all of the rest of our programs this year to organize them. And without him, none of this would be possible. So Hector, thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for coming and doing this. And I do want to say, if you are about to finish high school and are looking for a gap year program, obviously this is the one to choose. But if that doesn't describe you and you're looking to explore Jewish communities around the world, and you don't want to pay for all the plane tickets and the hotels and all the rest, please feel free to come here to the library of JTS. We are open to anybody who would like to use our resources, both our general collection and our special collections. And we invite you to come back. Please look for our programming next year. So thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was wonderful. I want to go on.
Of course.
You know.
I want to go on. Sure.
You want to go on. Sure.
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 Sure.